Hello, this is Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly, welcoming you to the TripCast during a great week for the state because earlier this week, the new Ross Perot Museum of Science opened in Dallas and you can move a ping pong ball with your mind, which Reeve Hamilton is looking forward to doing as soon as possible. Here you are, Reeve.
Thank you, Erica. This is Reeve Hamilton, reporter with the Texas Tribune, with the TribCast for the first week of December. Joining me is editor-in-chief and CEO Evan Smith.
Yo.
That's all you got?
I got nothing else. I'm trying to be on my best behavior. We have a guest.
Yes. Ross Ramsey, the executive editor. He's not our guest, but he is here.
Howdy.
And Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly and introducer extraordinaire, has joined us as our special guest.
Hi, guys. Hi.
Anything to say to our guest, Evan?
I'm glad she's here.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be talking.
How's Burka?
Oh, Burka is great. He's great.
First lie of the podcast.
Paul Burka?
Yeah. No. Burka as in the clothes. I'm asking about the clothes.
Yeah.
Jake has instituted a new regime where Erica can only show her eyes.
They have
a
very, very difficult dress code at Texas Monthly.
I was hoping no one would say that on this podcast, and that's why I agreed to the audio podcast. Thanks, Evan, for blowing my cover.
Yes, if it becomes a TV show, you're totally not doing it.
So embarrassing.
I get it.
I hate when this happens.
Well, tell Burka hello. I haven't seen him.
I will. He's great because he has me to hang out with now.
Yes, you improve it. I definitely agree. You improve things.
I think we feel like Burka here now that you've joined us.
I really am a pleasure. So
yeah, I think it's elevated all of us.
Should we get started?
you've obviously never listened to the podcast,
right.
Erica.
This is
the getting started.
We're on our 160th episode, and we're still waiting to get started.
Right.
Okay.
But we can't get started with our first topic, which is business incentives. I don't know if anyone here reads the New York Times.
Apparently, Jim Henson does. He didn't stop tweeting about it.
Yeah, social media
needs to get a hobby.
It is the worst.
Yeah.
So Texas doles out $19 billion in tax incentives for businesses a year.
This is not a huge surprise, though, right?
New York Times story. Should we feel fleeced?
Maybe the magnitude of this.
I guess it's astonishing to hear the number all added up, but it's not astonishing that we do this. The Texas has been giving away money and tax incentives for years and years and years to get businesses to move here. And you sort of, in the back of my mind, I've always wondered if they would move here without the bribes. But, once you get this sort of system established, everybody expects the money. We did it with the film industry for a long time. We've done it for years. This is just sort of a regular way of doing business here.
But the question is, what are we getting for it, right? That's the obvious question being posed by this
series. Yeah, the question is, if there weren't any bribes, would they come anyway?
Well, that's part of the question. But the second part of the question is, are we getting, having established that bribery is the law of the land,
right?
What are we getting for it, right? And the question is, are we getting enough of it, whatever it is? And I think that obviously the people who are paying the bribes would work very hard to argue that we're getting a lot for it. But I don't know.
But isn't the question also, what are we giving up? Like money for
schools? $19 billion, for one thing.
Well, did you get 19? The fast question is, did you get $19 billion back? Plus, right? Was it worth what you put in? And, the argument that the Rick Perrys make and that, the George Bushes made and the Ann Richards made is that, you put this money in and they come and they, create jobs and provide economic development and all of that, and that it's well worth the money.
You used to work for The Economist, so you can do math. What does that mean?
I'm great at math. I think it part of the challenge is that the money being distributed is not immediately connected to the outcomes that are projected, right? So think about things like the new Biodefense Center at A&M, which was a big grant from the TEF a couple of years ago that was pretty controversial and had some of the crony-ish elements that people find off-putting. So when that grant was first made, it seemed like a blatant giveaway for no reason. But then 2 years later, that's part of why A&M gets this huge federal contract that's going to pay back many times more than what the state put in.
Which I think they said something about at the time, right? They anticipated that this would have a medium-term
right.
consequence.
And everyone thought it was stupid.
They said that at the time. They also said that, that they were going to be curing cancer and the
well. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it
will.
Sometimes it works, and sometimes it's a super collider.
Right.
But the appearance, as you indicate or as you allude to, the appearance was Aggie Governor.
Mm-hmm.
Aggie Governor's discretionary fund, which is not exactly accurate, but is effectively accurate.
Right.
Money goes to Texas A&M. There must be
lots of personal connections there too.
Right. There must be a problem.
Right.
But the thing is with that situation, I think that he also took on he took on that sort of the risk of all of this falling apart, right? They didn't know that that grant was going to be out there when they first gave the first $50 million to Tigham, which was this mouse knockout thing.
Right.
But yeah, then Perry stuck around long enough, much to, I think, many people's surprise, to see the fruition of this plan. And if you talk to him, he'll tell you that he's been actively trying to create this sort of the environment for a biocorridor all along. It's sort of been sort of the strategy at play. So, I mean, he can say it sort of paid off. But if it hadn't paid off, then it would have just been him giving $50 million every few years to his cronies.
We're kind of in counterfactual territory, though, because you could look at it and say, well, A&M has this historic expertise in engineering and agriculture, and these are things that are related to vaccines, so it's not an entirely implausible suggestion they'd have for themselves. I don't know. I mean...
But again, to Ross's point, yes. To Ross's point, though, it's not a this or not this. It's this versus something else concrete.
Right.
And so what people around the state who are on the receiving end of budget cuts and public ed or financial aid will tell you, or people who turn on their taps and no water comes out because we have a $53 billion unfunded water plan, or people who look at the road funding hole. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Or the road funding hole that we know is now projected to be more than $300 billion just to maintain current roads at current population levels. They will tell you that that $19 billion might not go the entire way to solving the problems of the state, but that $19 billion may have gone some of the way, and maybe some of that business would have happened without the state paying.
Right.
This was the big, we all remember to some degree, I suspect, when the big move to infill in Austin happened. We're going to relocate a bunch of big technology companies and other companies in town. We're going to give people incentives to locate in town, and all great things will happen. There was, again, a similar pushback at a much smaller level. Well, you're basically giving incentives to people who don't need them. These are successful corporations, and why should they get any money from public accounts to do what they would do or should do otherwise?
Well, you know, Amazon wants to deliver books and products in Texas. Yeah. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's in the same ballpark. And you say, you know, you got to pay sales taxes. And they say, if you make us pay sales taxes, we'll close down our fulfillment centers. And you say, okay, close them. Right. And they went, how about we pay taxes?
Right.
They came around. You know,
don't negotiate with terrorists.
The other thing, you know, to Reeve's point is, you know, when you give these things, you don't assume you're going to be governor, I don't think, for 12 years. And
you assume you're going to be governor for 40 years.
Well, we give the money in present tense. And usually what happens is that if it goes wrong, it doesn't go wrong on your watch. And somebody says, hey, that guy back there, and everybody says, hey, whatever. It doesn't come back. The political benefit and the political piece of this is mostly present tense. The minute you give the check for $50 million or you help this company or you help, you know, that, you get to stand out there, you get to cut the ribbon, you get to put it on your commercials, you get to say you're for jobs. And most of the time, the results, positive or negative, come after you're gone.
It's set it and forget it. But, you know, there's a substantive piece, which is what we're talking about, but there's a process piece. Mm-hmm. What I recall during the 2010 governor's race was questions of whether the Emerging Technology Fund dollars, which are a version of this discussion, right? They're an incentive pool. That there was, it is a review process where X amount of people are brought in to vet these proposals, and then they recommend them upstream. And there was one, I'm recalling the particulars of this, that there was one instance where it didn't make the review process cut, and yet somehow it still went ahead, and ultimately they received the money. And then, well, we appealed, but there's actually no appeals process. Where this gets a little hinky is where, offline from whether incentives in general are a good idea or a bad idea, whether the process seems rigged to enable connected people to cut line,
right?
To cut the line. And you know, I mean, it, ever
what
thus,
did you call it? Crony-like circumstance?
I call it crony-ish. I mean, it does have that appearance. I think that's a pretty fair assessment. It does seem like there's some cronyism in the state. I think, you know, what's one thing that's weird to me about Texas is that people seem like they really don't have a problem with cronyism. They seem unusually sanguine about it.
They don't tend to vote against it. I mean, no. You know, Kay Hutchison raised the point against Perry, and it's
right.
Sort of
but of course, the response to Senator Hutchison was, "So what are you telling us that when you get into office, you're going to appoint your enemies?" I mean, the idea that politicians would appoint their financial supporters or their friends is not exactly new.
But this is our second weekly defense of cronyism.
Yeah, we had this discussion last week. Apparently, there's some podcasters that are very into cronyism too.
Yes.
But but there's a difference between appointing your friend to a judicial seat
or to an ambassadorship, right?
If they have, I mean, you could, if you have friends that have certain sets of experience and friends that don't, right? I mean, if you appoint a friend that's qualified, that's one thing. If you appoint a friend that's not qualified, that's a different thing.
Okay, but who gets to decide what or who is qualified?
That's
That's the issue. Well, no, I don't.
No, not
well, the issue on appointments is one thing.
Case.
I mean, when you're a governor, you get to make appointments, and we all know that when we elect you. But when we elect you, we don't necessarily hand you a checkbook and say, write your friend's checks with taxpayer money, which is what the cronyism in this case would amount to. If we're going to have a program to provide incentives or bribes or whatever you want to call them to businesses who will locate here or expand here or stay here or whatever, that's one issue. The second issue is having decided to dole out that money, how you're going to dole it out. And if you're going to dole it out to your pals, you know, that's probably a different level of cronyism than just, you know, appointing people in the way that we thought you would probably appoint people when we elected you, right?
Right. No, I think that's right. I think that's totally fair. I don't think voters have turned against it. I see no evidence that people have objected.
Right.
And
so it's not just.
And there's a third issue, which is that you claim job creation when you do these kinds of deals, but really it's job theft. Because you're not creating jobs that didn't exist. You're taking jobs from other places because your bribe is better than the bribe in the state where they're located. So to claim that somehow you've, quote, created jobs is really not accurate. You've really relocated jobs. What this is really is a relocation fund.
Well, you've created jobs in Texas.
Right.
Well, you've added jobs to Texas.
You've created some jobs. So there are some industries that are new and they're growing.
But in a lot of instances, when you take a company that's located in California or someplace else and you have them locate here instead because your bribe is a bigger bribe, it's not exactly the case that you're,
right.
quote,
no, that's
creating
right. That's
jobs.
Right. And that's where it gets into the troubling race to the bottom territory with state giveaways. But there are states that do these things well. I think about North Carolina and how they took their money from the tobacco settlement and plowed a lot of it into building out kind of biotech incentives and community college courses where you could learn how to be a biotech assistant and whatnot. And I think that was a good use, I think, of state steering to support that.
Well, the film thing that Ross brought up is interesting, and this was actually the third part of Louise Story's series on this was the Timesist. I don't know that she wrote all the stories, but the third part of the series was about Hollywood incentives, and I thought it was quite hilarious that Michael Moore received almost $1 million in incentives to make a film about how the capitalism in this country is screwed and how cronyism is rampant in corporate welfare, and yet he received effectively corporate welfare to make the movie. Having been involved at the Austin Film Society as a board member and as the president of the board and having witnessed up close these discussions on the film stuff, I can tell you that it may be the case that a big company would locate jobs here or would locate a plant here even if there were no incentives. But what Louisiana and New Mexico did to the film business during the first decade of this century was essentially outbid Texas for a lot of films that were set in Texas.
Well, they're still doing
it. You know, films, the Don Haskins movie, the film about Glory Road, about the great University of Texas at El Paso coach was filmed outside of Texas.
Well, everybody thinks we're in New Mexico anyway, in El Paso.
When the story was set here, because New Mexico offered better incentives than Texas did.
Well, you know,
Louisiana
Road,
has been famously doing this for some time, too.
Glory Road was the impetus for the state's sort of, some people think,
non-disparagement
horrible,
clause.
You can't film, you can't get incentives for a film that depicts Texas in a bad
light. In a negative
which
light.
Robert Rodriguez ran afoul of with machete.
But the point here is if Texas, and Texas has put
some
back into.
It's our money, we ought to be able to.
Texas has put back into, well, the problem is your disparagement may not be my disparagement, right? We may view that differently.
Well, the some lawmakers didn't like the portrayal of East Texans as racists in Glory Road.
Yeah, that's hardly ever happened in East Texas.
Right. But the point here is that in that instance, if you don't offer
a moment of silence,
it was. If you don't offer it, that's okay. We just lost Lufkin. If you don't,
McEnuchus, come on.
If you don't offer incentives in that case, there's absolutely no question. It is a proven fact that the film companies will go wherever the highest bid is.
Right.
And so you got to just accept the fact that if you don't want to be in the incentives business, you're going to lose some business.
Film is just the dumbest thing to incent for a state. I think if I was incenting businesses, I would incent them just long enough to trap them here so they can't leave ever again.
Right.
And films can They do leave.
Like the girl in the well in Silence of the Lambs?
Only people who have to put lotion on his back, is that what we're talking about now?
Evelyn sent you to build a huge headquarters.
She doesn't want any service business.
No, but that is one of the questions with film, right? They come, they make their movie. They generate a little bit of action, and then they leave. But theoretically, it's the tourism that it brings
I remember when the Selena movie was made in San Antonio. I remember that actually there was quite a bit of – they received an incentive. I think it was off of the bed tax in San Antonio. I remember some deal where they got credits
hotel motel tax,
but that it ultimately resulted in X number of people who came to work here for a period of time, and the restaurants in San Antonio benefited from that, and the hotels, in fact, themselves benefited, and – various craft services benefited, and Texas Cruise benefited as well. I remember for some reason that was an early instance in which the theory of the case was said to be proven, that if you you give them a little bit and they come here, that you get back, the multiple is quite significant.
You've got to be able to say, but for this investment, this would not have happened.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as a result of this investment, in fact, this positive thing did. So, you know, the late example right now is Formula One, right? Mm-hmm. So you put some kind of money on the table.
Yeah,
you
it's get the mother of all examples.
Get them,
to
build a track. But, you know, the first year, and, you know, this may change, the first year experience in downtown Austin, if you talk to downtown Austin merchants, all this stuff comes to town, all these people come to town, they close all these streets, it's a big party, it's a big fair, how'd you do? They say, well, you scared off the regulars and these people all went to the special booths. So, you know, their first year experience isn't great.
Right, but what the Formula One people would say, the people who built the track is that this is not really about the race. It's about all the other stuff. It's about all the events that are attracted to Austin, the conventions that didn't have a space to locate, even the convention center downtown. They have convention space. They've got a tournament-style soccer facility and a tennis facility. They've got three Zilker Parks worth of green space.
So
the rest of the year, there's going to be economic development dollars that come to Austin and Central Texas. It's not just the race.
So they've got a business case to make that we're starting this thing, we're building this big thing, we're going to make a ton of money on it, it's going to be great. Other people, as it turns out, are going to make a ton of money on it too. The question is, would they have made money on that? Can they make money on that? Is that a good business without any public money in it? And if it is, why are you putting any public money in it?
Well, of course, the public money process with that particular project has been dogged by sort of going around the rules and sort of
this is the major events trust fund.
Well, but the major events
administration of that out of the comptroller's office.
But the major events trust fund is based on this premise that if you spend a dollar here, it's worth $3. It's the idea that, you know, Texas A&M has some economists who've specialized in sports economics, and they, you know, one of their studies was, you know, if you do girls softball tournaments in small to mid-sized towns, they actually travel with more family members than boys do. It's a big economic development thing. And if you go to College Station right now, there's a big girls softball tournament, girls soccer tournament, all that kind of stuff, sort of built on that idea. And the idea was, throw some public money at it, you'll build something that wasn't there before, that wouldn't happen otherwise,
and you'll make all your money back over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of the, you know, that's the model behind the Major Events Trust Fund. If you build a big giant stadium that looks like the box that Ranger Stadium came in on I-30 and put the Cowboys in it, will we get our money back? Well, Jerry Jones might have built that anyway, right?
Maybe we should have asked Jerry Jones if he was going to build it anyway.
And what's he going to do? Make him
and then just proceed on that basis.
Take him to Arkansas?
Just figure out what he's going to say.
Well, let's stop looking into Jerry Jones's mind and try to figure out what David Simpson's going to do with regard to the speaker's race. So Evan broke the story that David Simpson is...
I didn't break the story. Jay broke the story. I just piggybacked on Jay.
You guys were on the phone. Come on. What did he say?
I will say this. It was great fun to be back. You know, I just basically... I'm not a journalist anymore, right? I just sort of sit around gassing with people. I don't actually do any reporting. So all of a sudden, I was like, ooh. I had a bit back of my mouth. It was great. I had gotten a tip that there was going to be some shakeup in the speaker's race, and, you know, it quickly became clear from calling around that it was likely going to run through David Simpson. Initially, we had gotten some guidance that Brian Hughes might be dropping out, and Jay was able to get Brian Hughes by text to say not only wasn't he dropping out, but that he was doubling down, essentially, in it to win it, you know, running hard and all that. But I reached David Simpson in Longview, and David Simpson confirmed what had been suspected, which is that he's looking really hard at getting in a race, and he said he's praying about it, and that he expected to make a decision pretty quickly. And he had a case to make for how the minorities by which he means the Democrats, rights within the body were not being adequately respected by the Speaker. This was exemplified, I think, previously by his endorsement of Trey Martinez Fisher's attack on the Speaker over the redistricting process.
Right. Yeah, Martinez Fisher tried to lay the intentional discrimination noted by the Justice Department
at the feet of either Strauss or Strauss's agents.
Right.
Let me say a word about Simpson, because I actually find Simpson to be a very fascinating guy. You know, we are in the business of covering everybody in the legislature with equal enthusiasm and passion, but like you love your children equally, though on some days you maybe love certain children more equally than others. I love
so
David
personal
Simpson.
Personal note to Carson, is it?
Well, no, or Wyatt. I love David Simpson in some respects more equally than a lot of the other guys because he tends to be more interesting to cover. There are a bunch of people in there who do good work and they mean well for Texas and all that blah de blah.
It's not
but
a priority, though.
They're not entertaining.
It's crazy talk.
I want crazy talk. Entertain me. I want to be entertained. David Simpson, from a political standpoint, is the Mr. Bojangles of the legislature, you know. I want David Simpson to be tap dancing for me at all times, and David Simpson never fails to be interesting or entertaining. You know, the guy's got a very strong point of view. He believes what he believes. He does not need the classic weather vane to tell you which way the wind is blowing. He doesn't listen to consultants. He follows his own set of coordinates.
Right.
And that has been demonstrated time and again in his short time in the legislature, where he's taken up issues that nobody else would take up, and he's pressed them well beyond the point that any typical politician would press them. And he's bucked his party's orthodoxy a couple of different ways and times. Mm-hmm. And stylistically, he's not the same kind of guy.
Right.
Of course, the press always loves anybody accessible to the press. So let me accept that is part of this, and let me put it to the side. But I find David Simpson to be really interesting, and you know, he's no dummy. He's a real smart guy. I think he cares about the things he cares about. And so,
sort of setting aside your love of him for a second,
yes.
If he decides to get in the speaker's race, does he have any shot?
No.
Well, no. And here's why. I mean, look, we're going to get accused. We'll be attacked by all those
party bloggers. Already have
been. Yeah. Right. For somehow we have it in for we're in the tank for Strauss. No, we're not in the tank for Strauss. We're in the tank for mathematics.
Oh, you're okay? Regular Nate Silver.
We're in the tank for mathematics. Oh, I'm a cool Nate Silver. We're in the tank for mathematics.
Wow. Debate.
Okay? You get to 76 votes, you're speaker.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The cake is baked favorably for the incumbent. Always, unless you can prove, not Strauss, it was that way for Craddock. If I was for Strauss, then I was for Craddock. Mm-hmm. If I was for Craddock, then I was for Laney. The cake is baked favorably for the incumbent.
Right.
Show me that you have the numbers to dethrone the king. Otherwise, you don't have a route there. Show me the numbers.
Right. You have to have a widespread complaint.
Right.
Right.
What you call a bill of particulars.
Right. You've got to have a bill of particulars. You've got to have a widespread complaint that has enough people reconsidering their decision to reelect somebody. And then you have to have somebody who is acceptable to those complaining members. And the problem here, I mean, you know, sort of the coalition math is that you're trying to unseat a speaker who won his job with moderate Republicans and Democrats with someone who would have to win votes from conservative Republicans and Democrats. And that coalition just won't gel.
And you may not like the fact that there are moderate Republicans in the House. And you may not like the fact that the math works out the way that it does to have Democrats and moderate Republicans thwart your guys.
Right.
Change that. Until then, prove it. And they say, well, Strauss hasn't proved that he has the votes. No, you haven't proved the votes that you have the votes to beat him.
Well, somebody, I wrote a thing on this, and somebody said, you know, how is it that you think Strauss has this in the bag if he only has 30 votes? We did a survey. We asked a bunch of members. Most of them said, are you kidding? I'm not answering that question. Part of them because they said, I've got to go home and talk to my constituents before I tell anybody publicly how I'm going to vote. But the point is, the people who did say how they were going to vote included 29 or 30 for Strauss, one for Hughes. Simpson
which
wasn't
was Brian Hughes.
Which was Brian Hughes. He decided after some
but now he might
some
be
conversations with the candidate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just don't think, you know, everybody was mad at Craddock for years before they actually had enough people mad at Craddock to say, well, wait a minute, this is possible. Who do we want to elect? Mm-hmm. And then they inexplicably and surprisingly came up with Joe Strauss, right? But the first thing was a significant number of people running around saying, you know, the king must fall. And I don't think that exists right now.
What hole does David Simpson see that Brian Hughes isn't filling from the
David Simpson's the interesting because, you know, kind of what Evan is talking about. He is his own guy. He doesn't necessarily belong to anybody's group, and he has the advantage of, you know, he's done this smartly in some ways. He's an independent guy. He's a free agent. He's an independent player, and so nobody thinks he's beholden to some outside group. So the agenda here, so the agenda here is clear if you know Simpson. It's David Simpson's agenda. It's not some group behind him or something behind him. So, I mean, he's got kind of the strength of his convictions, and everybody has watched him and sort of is convinced that, okay, he is what he says he is. So he's got that. But I don't think that there's a complaint that he's the solution to.
Do you guys even think we're going to see a serious speaker's race?
Not this time.
Well, I mean, I would hold the door open to anything, mm-hmm. in the sense that who knows what will happen between now and January 8th. But in the apps, this is the point. Mm-hmm. The people who want to dethrone Strauss think that they should just be able to dethrone Strauss by assertion. No, right. There's got to be action. Mm-hmm. In the absence of any change to the current dynamic, Strauss gets reelected. He gets reelected overwhelmingly. Show me a precipitating event that causes this to be different.
It's very
risky. David Simpson's entrance into this race make it less likely or more likely that Strauss loses? I would argue less likely, in that the opposition to Strauss, the ABS vote, is divided now.
Yeah.
Right? It's not unified. The thing that Simpson has going for him over Hughes is that Simpson is more of a purist as a conservative in that.
He's not a trial lawyer.
Well, I think you can overstate the extent to which Hughes' status as a conservative trial lawyer, but a trial lawyer nonetheless, is a negative. But TLR, for instance, is not enthusiastic. TLR, which has been the great bankroller and enabler of many of these insurgents over the last couple cycles, TLR is not interested in Hughes.
I think if you're a Democrat,
maybe they're interested in Simpson, but they're probably more likely to be interested in Strauss. I think don't you think that TLR is more likely to back the speaker?
Well, they're an establishment group, and he's the establishment guy.
Real politics, I mean,
it's,
you know, right? This they is, understand
you know, that. You know, it's much easier if you were a Democrat unsatisfied with Strauss to vote for Hughes than for Simpson. And I think the problem that a Simpson has is that that coalition is impossible to hold together. You could maybe unite people, you know, you could hypothetically unite people around, don't we all hate that guy together, right? But when you get to the point of saying, and the solution is blank, I think it's very hard to make that coalition between liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans against a guy who occupies, you know, such as it is, the middle of the House.
Well,
yeah, I think that's right. And what's striking to me about the whole thing is how few Republicans have tried to stake out that middle ground, given that that seems like where the median Texan voter is.
I think the median Texan may be there, but I don't think the median Texan voter is. I think they got to run in Republican primaries. You know, you've got this deal where you've got, you know, 13 or 14 million voters, and you've only got 742,000 people deciding Republican primaries. Those are the people they're afraid of, and they're the most Republican Republicans.
And to some degree, the likelihood of Strauss's reelection, although I'm going to reverse myself on this with another example in a second, but the likelihood of Strauss's reelection makes it harder for a Hughes or a Simpson to get traction in this respect. Who wants to be seen supporting a candidate other than the speaker and then go into the session? As somebody who is allied with the speaker said to me the other day, Gordon can read a Texas Ethics Commission
Gordon
filing.
Johnson,
Gordon Johnson, mm-hmm. who is the speaker's enforcer.
Well, he's his political consigliere.
And the idea was anybody who gives money to Simpson or Hughes, the speaker's office is going to take note of this.
So you have to get – this is why you have to have the bill of particulars. You have to have a bunch of people mad enough at him to take the risk.
Fear of Dewhurst being returned to the Senate didn't prevent a bunch of people from supporting Cruz.
It did for a long time,
A bunch of people.
Well, but in the end, I mean, Cruz got still in the first round of the deal. Cruz got – what did he get into 40%? What did Cruz get in the first round? Those people didn't know that Dewhurst wasn't going to get reelected eventually.
How many senators
they were willing
did he get?
To buck.
No, but only one senator refused to sign that letter supporting.
Right, but I'm not talking about Dewhurst. I'm not talking about the question of members. Right. I'm talking about the lobby. It was said during the Senate race that the lobby was reluctant to support anybody other than Dewhurst because if he won, he was U.S. Senator. And if he lost, he was a pissed off lieutenant governor.
Right.
My point is, Dewhurst still lost. So it's probably not exactly right to say that fear of Strauss winning might prevent people from from supporting somebody else.
The difference here is that you only have 149 voters here.
You're not
talking about the public as you in that case.
That's right.
And the senators didn't
go
against
Dewhurst. I'm also thinking about the lobby. I mean, I think what the person was saying about Gordon Johnson was that no one's going to give money to Simpson, say, and be visibly opposed to the speaker because people have long memories.
Well, and the lucky thing for Simpson is it doesn't cost any money to run a speaker's race.
And he will be a free media speaker candidate.
Right.
And
that's right. But I just don't think the complaint's there yet. I just don't think that the bill of particulars against Strauss has been assembled yet. It will be. I mean, every speaker, you know, it's like those radiation badges they give you. You know, at some point you have too much. You got to get out of the plant. You know, Laney gets too much. Craddock gets too much. It just, you know, all of the deals and actions you take over time accumulate against you, and at some point it becomes time for a new speaker. I don't think we're there yet.
Well, and the other thing I'd say as a cap on this is, if you ask people, how would Speaker Paxton have been different than Speaker Strauss? Or how would Speaker Hughes be different from Speaker Strauss? Theoretically, the most powerful answer is a list of substantive things that would have happened but did not happen, or would not have happened but did. Mm-hmm. When I asked Brian Hughes a couple weeks ago, talk about the substantive case for your speakership, his answer was process.
Right.
Well, committee assignments. Well, if somebody wants to wage a speaker's race purely on the basis of process, good luck.
Well, it seems like you're not going to get a lot of the sort of excited support from the right if your argument, Simpson, going in is that he's not treating the Democrats nicely enough.
Well, and Strauss has the advantage of all of his chairmen, either, you know, a bunch of his chairmen are leaving or got beat. And there's a lot of stuff to hand out. There's a lot of, you know,
gifts
to give.
As a wise man once said,
you're not going to have the. You know, one of the complaints against Laney in particular, to a lesser extent against Craddock, was that all the top jobs were taken. There's nothing for me here. What else you got? Strauss doesn't have that problem yet, or this time.
Well, if any listeners would like any gifts from us, or have any questions or comments, they can email tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of...
Well, can we just ask Erica, what's your first thing for Texas Monthly now that the ink on your business cards is not yet dry? What are you working on?
Oh, well, I've been doing some web stuff, but I'm not going to do anything for the magazine until the session. We'll do best and worst.
And so you are going to be...
I'll be writing online. We're launching a new website in January, which is going to be fantastic.
And you're covering the Senate or the House?
I'm covering the Senate, which is going to be a lot of fun, although perhaps not as fun as the House.
This session, it might be more fun.
They're both pretty fun.
I think that the change in the Senate this time, with the addition of these Hancock and Paxton, Taylor, Schwertner, and Dr. Campbell, is going to be a party in a box.
They'll both
be a lot of fun for people like us who think this is kind of fun.
Keep the Senate very cold.
The problem with the Senate is that they, you know, do all their substantive work off stage in the Betty King room, unless you're hiding under a chair. It's very difficult to have fun.
Which maybe I will be. So
if you're hiding under a chair, you can have fun?
If you're in the Betty King room, you know what's going on.
All right. That's a good pro plan. Tip.
Thanks, Ross.
Pro tips, right?
Hashtag pro tip. All right. And the damn podcast.
On behalf of Evan, Erica, Ross, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
I got to say, I like working alone.
That can be arranged. That can be arranged, you expensive motherfucker. I mean, come on.